Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone. I am your host, Veronica Monet, and tonight we're going to take a little journey down the birth canal. Okay, not really down the birth canal, but we are going to be talking about birth and all of its spiritual and physical. Okay. And for you listeners, we're having a little bit of a rough start today. So, anyway, Nicole, you were saying about the U.S., the U.S. is horrific rate of C-sections.
Seth had a question about C-sections. We could ask him.
Yes, he is. He's a dad,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, that's kind of the what's being brought forward, you know, is what's going on. Our numbers aren't looking so good, you know. They're not going in the right direction.
We actually have a pretty high infant mortality rate, don't we?
Right. Yeah, we're not great. I think, you know, these are not numbers that I have right off the top of my head, but definitely we're not great. I feel like we're like 22nd or something.
Yes, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Now, part of the problem is that people that have other tools, midwives, let's say, they have not been respected very much by the medical community. And I could say that it goes two ways. I wouldn't say that very many midwives have a ton of respect for the medical community either. And you obviously have a spectrum, like as I've been looking at this more and more, it really is a spectrum. You have people that are don't want anything messed with at all while they're birthing, even to the point of unassisted birth. Women that want to be completely by themselves when they birth. Michelle O'Daw, who you know you've heard me talk about before, he actually says a lot of things that are pro-woman either being alone or only attended by a midwife that is essentially in the back corner and not really doing much. So you have that. This is my spectrum that I've sort of come up with as I've been looking at the terrain of birth. And so that's one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum, I would say, is I'm scheduling my cesarean, you know, at 39 weeks, and that's it. So there's this huge terrain in between, and I think, based on my own thinking about this, and I imagine I'm not alone in thinking about this, that really who's losing out, there's little mini wars going on in between. You know, you can say this right about the right and the left in politics, too. There's like these little mini wars going on all along the place that unfortunately everyone is so, or not everyone, but a lot of people are very adamant about their way of doing it to the point of not having respect for the person next to them on either sides of the paradigm, let alone at the ends of it. And who really lose out then are the mothers and the babies and the families.
Mm.
What I mean is you could have a midwife, you could decide I would like to have a home birth, and you find the midwife that you like the most, and they may live in a town where they're concerned that their license will be taken from them, or maybe they don't even have a license. Maybe their mothers and grandmothers were midwives, and this is a skill that they learned through generations of having it passed down, and so they don't actually have any legal credentials. But this is the person that you feel the most comfortable having attend your birth. But they cannot let people know, you know, legally they could be in some sort of trouble if the government knew that they were doing it. And you might have a hospital with doctors who have never seen a home birth and are very against home birth, and they, so therefore this midwife is sort of in hiding. So you have a woman who's under her care because this is the type of care she'd like to have, and say the baby does, you know, something starts to happen where the midwife feels like maybe you might need a hospital, but that midwife doesn't want the hospital to know that she even exists. And then that mother could show up at the hospital, and the hospital could have a very bad opinion of her, to the point of even some, I think that there was a president of the OBGYN Association at one point that said he considered home births child abuse. So you have this terrain of people who are vehemently pro whatever it is they're doing, and losing sight really of the woman and the family and helping them navigate bringing another person into the world.
It seems like it's incredibly politicized.
Yeah, it really is. You know, and in a lot of ways it makes sense. I mean, think about all the distress and shame and power around sex, right? I know that's, you know, something you know a little bit about.
Yes.
So, you know, and I've been known to say that birth is the mini-me of sex. So,
okay.
You know, you just take it. You just take it that much bigger.
Well, but so I know, but I'm thinking, like, what you've talked about in your newsletter is that birth is kind of the subtext for every other aspect of life. And
right.
I found that very intriguing. It's kind of something that we do put off in a corner, I think. And we kind of talk about birth like it was this isolated event that happens just once. But I think you kind of have an expanded view of birth. It's kind of a metaphor for everything else that we're doing in life.
Yeah, well, there's also more and more research coming out. I wish I could remember what this acronym stands for. There's a group called APA. And there's more and more research coming out to, you know, I think even there was like a New York Times article recently, or New York, you know, the New York Magazine, New York Times Magazine article that was talking about the experience in utero, you know, what the child, what the baby goes through before it ever even comes out. So there's more and more research. It used to be thought that babies couldn't feel pain, right? So they would do procedures on babies without any anesthesia. And,
oh, God.
And, you know, as our, yeah, as science would, as science has caught up and we're more aware of what I think a lot of mothers have been innately aware of, which is that actually, you know, and we know this, right? We know that if, like, for instance, you have a child who is abused and you know that that's going to affect them later on in their life. So why would that not exist? Like, when do we deem it, okay, at this age, it will affect them for the rest of their lives? Right? Like, are we saying that? So if you go further and further back, all the way to in utero and all the, you know, or to birth.
Yeah. You know, but a lot of us can't remember our birth, and don't you think that's where some of this disconnect is? We're just kind of like dumbfounded with the idea that our birth, our actual birthday, could have anything to do with the rest of our lives because we can't remember it.
Yeah, that's very possible. I mean, I'm somebody who I say speaks body, you know. I mean, my mom started a massage school. She became a massage therapist when I was, maybe 4 or 5. And she, you know, started a massage school by the time I was 8. So I very much grew up, and I started dancing when I was 4. I very much grew up in my body, and I say that I speak body. So people that, you know, what we're talking about, this is actually a really good point, Veronica. You're so good at this. It's in our bodies. And it's in our minds because it's in our bodies, but it's not a memory like, oh, yeah, I can picture what I was watching that day. And, you know, and I will tell you that people that do rebirthing work through or deep tissue work, you may revisit your birth. You may revisit being in utero. I mean, there are counts of people doing this. We could say that, you know, maybe they're making it up. You know, I mean, it is hard to, like, say for sure, of course. But if we're going to say we don't know, if we believe that these people are actually going back to their birthing experience, then I will ask them again that question of, so at what age do you think something becomes poignant and affecting for the rest of your life?
Yeah, like horse to cut off. You know, this actually kind of reminds me of arguments I've had with my really super, my uber sex positive friends who say, I don't believe in an age of consent. I don't think there should be any age of consent laws. And I will say, well, okay, what about 10? Okay, you don't think, you don't care about 10. Okay, what about 5? What about 3? What about 1? And pretty soon they'll be like going, okay, I do believe in age of consent. And, okay, well, it's just a matter of what age. What age does it offend you?
That's a particularly interesting topic to me because, you know, Alina and I have this monthly discussion about sex-positive parenting.
Yes, I know you
do. And that particular piece is something that we have all discussed, you know, especially we've discussed it primarily around, like, puberty and when, you know, kids become teens, and it gets tricky.
Well, it does. It does. And I think it's very, very slippery slope. And yet, I just like to back it up to where it's so ridiculously early that I can at least get everybody to agree, okay, fine, we do believe that there's an age where, you know, you cannot give your consent. You do.
Right.
We all do. Yeah. We all believe that. So then,
and I have to say for myself as a parent, it got very tricky around car seats.
Around car seats?
Car seats, because my first daughter hated car seats. You know, she would scream in the car seat. And so it being important for me that she always have physical consent... got very confusing when I knew she had to go into a car seat for her to be safe in the car.
Oh, yeah.
But physically, I was oppressing her.
Yes. She probably hated it, huh?
Oh, she hated it. Hated it. With scream. Bloody murder. Luckily, when she was young, I lived in New York, so I didn't have to go in a car very often. But yeah, it was very important to me that I physically not oppress my child, you know, that as little as possible that I was physically overpowering her, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know, huh? And but we do have to protect her. I remember some footage, actually, of, you know, a dolphin correcting her child, her baby dolphin, because it got too close to a propeller on a boat. And she literally, knocked him senseless down to the bottom of the ocean. And, you know, it looked brutal, but she doesn't want him to get killed by a boat.
Right.
Yeah, so, mothers have to do what they have to do to keep their babies alive long enough for them to grow up and make mistakes they can handle the repercussions of, you know?
Yeah.
So what about this whole thing about remembering our birth? Do you remember yours? Do you know anybody who remembers theirs? Do you think it's even possible?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I grew up around rebirthing work, and I know people that have gone back to their births. I've had, I'm trying to think if I've had any memories of my actual birth. I definitely have had very early memories. I haven't actually, like, had numerous rebirthing sessions over and over again to try and get to that. There's a woman named Sunny Carl, S-U-N-N-I-K-A-R-L, I believe, and she wrote a book called Sacred Birthing, and she actually comes to midwifery care as a rebirther, that it was through her work rebirthing people that she learned about how many people were having traumatic births and how that was affecting their lives. And so then she turned her attention to birth and helping to shift that.
Wow.
So it's a very visceral type thing, you know, like when it's very holistic. Like, it's looking at this in a very holistic way. And part of why I've brought my attention to this work is because I speak body. So I, for instance, what does speak body look like? That, for myself, personally, that means perhaps I'm feeling some pain somewhere in my body. It's really driving me crazy. So I'm going to meditate on that and bring my attention to it, probably in a quiet space somewhere, maybe before I fall asleep at night. And as I'm in that state, all of a sudden, perhaps I start having some, you know, as I'm focusing on the pain, I might start having some emotion. I might start having some memories. Perhaps I want to not have the sensation, but I make a choice, or I want to not have the memory, or I want to not have the emotion, but I make a concerted effort to go towards it instead of running away from it. Because time after time that I've done this throughout my life, I know that I get healing on the other side of it. So I go closer and closer towards it, and sometimes in the process of going closer and closer towards it and deeper into it, I may all of a sudden recall something from very, very young in my life. So that would be one example of how perhaps a birth trauma could show itself. Now, I personally don't have a lot of birth trauma. My mom didn't have a really terrible birthing experience. But I have recalled memories of her feeling very alone, which is another conversation, you know, of like how the woman's feeling while she's birthing. We know that hormones, for instance, you know, through Candace Peart's work, she's showing that hormones are emotion. And we know that hormones course through the blood, and we know that the mother's blood courses through the baby. So the baby is probably experiencing the same emotions that the mother's feeling. So if the mother is feeling very distressed and frightened, or in my case it was very alone, that we could probably glean from that the child is experiencing that as well. And I've had that in my own processing. Like, as I've processed, I've reconnected to how alone she felt during the birth. And for me, that plays out as, I don't want to be alone at a birth. When I hear about an unassisted birth, I'm like, who on earth would want to do that?
Well, you know, now this whole medicalized birth culture seems to be predicated upon the idea that birth takes too long. Is that true? I mean, do you think that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know, because I haven't been trained in that vein. So I don't totally understand what all is going on there. And I do think that it's individual. I can say that I believe that there are several things going on, and you can read Ina May Gaskin's Birth Matters. It's her manifesto. Ina May Gaskin is who we call the mother of modern midwifery. The history is that, you know, maybe it was industrialization. I mean, it was pre-industrialization, though, I think. There was a process that went on of taking birth out of the home and putting it into the hospital, of taking it out of the hands of midwives and into the hands of doctors, at that time all men. The first OBGYNs had never attended a birth. They came out of medical school having been taught theories and sort of these really crude models of women, and they were given a certificate, and it said, okay, you can now go attend births, and they had never been at a birth. Whereas you had midwives who had been at birth after birth, but perhaps they did, you know, things like stuck a knife under the bed. You know, they might have had, like, different superstitious types of things that went with it. And in the marketing process, the superstitious stuff got pulled up to say that they were crazy and, you know, you should go and be with a doctor and be in a hospital. So there was this whole marketing campaign that went on, which is a part of the factor of how birth, there's another great book called Birth, The Surprising History of How We Were Born by Tina Cassidy, that just talks about how birth got out of the home, got out of the hands of women and midwives and into the hands of these, into the hospitals. Lots of women died in the beginning of getting them to the hospitals because they didn't know about that, you know, that a doctor could walk out of working with a cadaver, have his hands full of that blood, and then walk into a ward to help deliver babies. And so lots of women were getting infections.
It's amazing that this hospital birthing persisted. When you see that, midwife and doula-assisted births have a higher success rate, it's just amazing how entrenched it is in the culture that we will ignore the health facts, we'll ignore the fact that it's not working, and keep doing it.
Right.
Now,
well,
as far as I understand,
come up because luckily I feel like this generation might start to bridge the gap a bit more. And that is to say that the people with the, you know, like the countries with the best maternal mortality and infant mortality rates, they have, let's say, the majority of the births are handled by midwives, because the idea is that midwives are there for births for women that are not ill, for babies that are not ill. And
right.
The OBs are the doctors to handle when people are ill, you know, just like anything else.
And sure.
They communicate.
But that's not the model in the U.S. So what countries are you talking about?
No, that is not the model that the U.S. follows. And part of that is finances. A lot of that is finances. You may or may, and to some extent, the law. I mean, there are places where midwifery care, there are states that midwifery care is what they call illegal, which means you don't even know really if it's legal or illegal. There are something called certified nurse midwives, which are midwives that are trained through the hospital system but still in the midwifery model. And a certified nurse midwife could lose her license if she did a home birth, if she attended a home birth.
So do you want to address that, why it is that midwives became so persecuted and at what time historically that actually started happening? Because a lot of people probably don't know the history of that.
Me, personally, you want me to talk about it right now? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the exact numbers, and I believe it was at, like, the turn of the 1900s, early 1900s. And even I just read a book, what was it called? There's a whole thing about granny midwives down in the South. So these were, you know, the book that I read or the video, I saw a movie and I read a book. And you know, this is like her mom was a slave. And she, you know, women were around her having babies, and they needed help. So she started helping, and she became a midwife. And then slowly but surely, you know, the doctors came in and started, you know, it all started, I don't know, I mean, to a certain extent, I'm just envisioning this sort of industrialized assembly line mentality. You know, it's like, well, let's have them all come to the hospital And then efficiently, we can just do ba-boom, 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 as opposed to, I mean, I can tell you, as a doula and a midwife, your lifestyle's not all that efficient. It's hard to plan things when you're on call for births all the time and you don't know if the birth, you know, this woman could be laboring for days before she has her baby. It could look like it's labor and then it could stop. And, you know, I call it labor land. Like, women start to go into labor land, in my opinion, weeks before they have a baby, often. Or it could be really fast. So to a certain extent, I feel like it all marries the industrialization, you know, the industrial age of moving things into, we want to put everything in the same place, we want to treat everybody the same way, and it just, it doesn't
Well, I think that's a great observation. Of course, some of the information that I have studied indicates that it really you go way back to when the Catholic Church had that huge book called The Hammer, which was written by an archbishop, and it was all about how to persecute and try witches. But believe it or not, this book contained admonitions that midwives were actually more treacherous, more evil, more to be feared than witches.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not surprised.
So that overlay of literally, not metaphorically, literally demonizing the practice of home birth. And I think really leads us down this path where it becomes against the law. And then
at some point,
we start trying to justify it. But like so many religious prescriptions, they really come out of superstition, taboo, and habit, you know. And it's a very interesting thing because, the midwives become suspect and accused of witchcraft right around the time that the medical profession becomes male-dominated and women are not allowed to be doctors and they're not allowed to go to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So then if a woman was able to heal,
mm-hmm.
she had to be a witch.
Right.
And midwives were actually considered the worst offenders in this particular group. So I just
read a book by an OB in London, or in England. I'm pretty sure it's London, but definitely England. She's Sri Lankan her ancestry is Sri Lankan, and she might have even been born in Sri Lanka, and then she studied and became an OB in the UK, and she opted to have a home birth because she felt like what happened was as she got pregnant and was in her own body and connecting with her baby, it became overwhelmingly clear to her that the hospital was not the place to have her baby.
Yes.
And one of the lines that she wrote in her book, I'm not going to quote it perfectly because I don't have it in front of me, but it basically addressed this beautiful, you know, there's, when you said to me that this Hammer, you know, book very much saw the midwife as dangerous, it is an incredibly powerful role. And what she spoke to in the book in this one line so eloquently was that society often is terrified of transitions of role. And I know you've heard me talk about that motherhood is the transition from maiden to mother. And it is a huge transition. So not only do you have a child leaving a body and coming into the world and breathing breath, but you also have a woman who is turning from maiden to mother. And a midwife is the person who is holding space for that to happen. And in so many cultures, that person, that event, people who are going through that become frightening and dangerous. Because it messes with, the way she put it was, it messes with the fibers of culture. And what I wrote to her, you know, I worked we're friends on Facebook, you know. Everybody's friends on Facebook now.
So yes. We've been where we all live.
What? Yeah, that's where we all live. And I pulled that quote out and I wrote it. You know, I plugged her book basically with it and wanted to bring it out for people to speak about it. And I said, actually, you know, Amali is her name, I believe that peace resides in those spaces. When we learn to be in those transitions, when society learns to be able to navigate those huge transitions, that's when peace will exist.
So it's almost like we've taken this incredibly pivotal moment when you know, the sentient being crosses over into this area. I mean, you know, it's like however you envision that, however you think of it, whatever, you know, frames your reality, there is at some point a life form that's incapable of surviving without sustenance from another life form, and then there's a life form that is existing outside of that body.
So they can breathe, because they still need mama's milk.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, they can breathe air, at least.
Yeah. So that's a huge rite of passage. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's an amazing, amazing miracle. I think this is something that the ancients used to worship because they were so in awe of it. And it's almost
right,
like
exactly.
we don't want to be in awe of anything anymore. It's like, you know, we put those awe-inspiring things to the side. And
well, it's been all, you know, when you said that, in awe, I saw a IMAX screen. Right? Like it's all moved to fantasy and technology.
Yes. You can be in awe of something that you're not actually experiencing because you're watching it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've never seen a birth.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a birth. And I also, you know, it's like these two huge transitions, birth and death, which in a lot of ways is kept away from our eyes, away from our experience.
Yep.
We shuttle it off to the hospital. So you're born in a hospital, you die in a hospital, and there's no connection to community. And then those of us who might be informed by these life events don't have any connection to it. We have no experience.
Yeah, and what do we know happens to things that people don't ever see? I mean, then you place all your fears and anxieties around it because you don't ever see it. It doesn't become normalized.
Yeah.
Right?
So I wonder...
You know, and that's...
It's true. And Nicole,
you're... For a lot of OBs is that they never have seen... They might be anti-home birth and they've never seen one.
How many births have you attended?
Not a ton. I might be coming up on 20.
That's a lot. For our listeners, you know, chances are that, you know, there's about half of them out there that might have actually experienced a birth. And, you know, a certain percentage of those might have attended the birth of their own child by being at the side of their wife or girlfriend. But there's going to be listeners like myself, too, that have never actually been in the same room while another human being was being born. Would you be able to share with the listeners your experience of birth?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, or maybe not. I've heard every birth is different. That's something you can tell us. You can tell us, is each one different? Or maybe share how it's shaped the way you respond to life in general. And also, you keep talking about how you're living in your body. I wonder how being in attendance to other births has caused you to live in your body.
Well, I can speak for my two births and then the births that I've, you know, am honored to be a part of. They are all very different, and they are all very much affected by everybody involved and what's happening, which is, I think, one of the pieces that I would love for more people to become aware of. You know, people around birth are not often realizing how much they're affecting the birth by doing what they're doing and being who they're being. You know, this is part of why I call sex the mini-me of birth, because in many ways, they are similar. I mean, people from the sex-positive community that have been around me and listen to me talking about this, they're just constantly like, they'll tease me. They'll be like, you really need to get beat up. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And that's in response to me talking about the euphoria of birth that often is adjuncted to, intertwined with the pain of birth. You know, that to say that I had an ecstatic birth is not to say that it was free of pain. And they've, these people that are into BDSM have told me that it's very much the same way, which you might know more than I about that. So I can, you know, I'm trying to find parallels to help people connect with it to their own lives, which is a lot of what I do. Like when I'm saying I speak body, what I'm interested in is helping you viscerally connect to something, not just an idea and not just a concept, but to connect it to yourself and your own life and your own experience. So there's that piece. It's this extremely heightened physical experience. The mother goes into, you know, her body is working more than it ever will work, and its uterus is what is, you know, her uterus is what is working. So imagine this muscle inside of your body that's gotten huge, and it's, you know, moving and shaking, and so it's moving and shaking your body around, and that means is that it's, you know, as it moves, the other parts of you will also be affected by that movement. So you have this huge physical, you know, just mechanically physical experience going on, while you also have all these hormones adjusting. So that's, you know, some of what's happening for her as this child moves down her, you know, down from above her pelvis and down into her pelvis and through her pelvis and through her birth canal and all the worlds that exist there, you know, I mean, all the different shapes and forms that her body will take, and the baby at the same time is taking all these different forms and shapes to dance. They dance as the baby comes out. So being present for that is unique to each person and each child, you know. I mean, it's my attention is on being present and helping them to be present and helping them to move, helping them, you know, things to move. And that takes on all sorts of shapes and sizes. I've had, I often have my hands on their body while they're birthing because my hands do that. Mm. And the first birth that I attended, that I put my hands on them, you know, the mom, it was clear she didn't want me to be another form of movement for her. So whereas with some mothers, I've had, like, my hands totally massaging their pelvises to help things happen, and I'm very much feel almost like I'm a part of this, you know, movement. This other mom, like, it was clear I was just to place my hands there. It was not to place my hands there and actually try and do anything. They were just to sit there.
So this is a very intuitive experience.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah. And that's why I talk about oxytocin so much, is because I think it's the oxytocin state that helps us be intuitive.
And for our listeners who don't know what oxytocin is, this is actually a hormone that's released when two mammals touch each other. It creates a bonding sensation. It's what bonds the mother to the baby. And it happens to be at its highest during the birth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right before and right after the birth are like the highest. That transition is the highest time of oxytocin in your body if it's not messed with.
And can you speak just a little bit about oxytocin set points?
Yeah, so Michelle O'Donnell set this theory out. He wrote a book called Primal Health. I'm sure he's written other things on it as well. And O'Donnell is spelled Odent, O-D-E-N-T, and his name is Michael, but he's French, so it's Michelle O'Donnell. And, he throws out there that I think he's who coined oxytocin, the love hormone. And, I mean, there's so much. I'm teaching my more oxytocin class this Saturday, and I'm trying to, whenever I teach the in-person class, any of my in-person classes, I try and update all my research as best as I can. And the research on oxytocin is just taking off. I'm like, okay, I need to stop researching and get the class ready.
Really?
So basically this hormone it's created in more places than just your central nervous system. Like when I originally created the class, I was like, okay, looking at everything, I was like, okay, so it's primarily created in your hypothalamus, and then it has this neurotransmitter effect. Well, now come to learn from the brain that changes itself, which is about neuroplasticity, that it's actually a neuromodulator. And so it's not just a neurotransmitter. What oxytocin in your brain actually does is make your brain much more plastic. It makes it changeable. So it makes it easier for you to change how you feel about things, let's say. Or in a healing kind of way, you have a distressed situation, you bring the oxytocin in, and then you provide a healing situation, and perhaps the distress will release. It increases the chances that you can repattern your brain.
Wow.
It can go down into your bloodstream, and in your bloodstream, it's what causes your uterus to contract. And in the central nervous system, it has all these bonding effects. It's, and even in the blood, the plasma levels, when the plasma levels of oxytocin are increased, people trust more, they're more generous, there's more reciprocity, on and on and on. Well, now, they've got that your heart also makes oxytocin, and oxytocin affects your thymus, and it affects your heart, your cardiovascular system, it affects your kidneys, it affects there's very limited research, but they are aware that it affects your adrenals and your gonads. So there's like, it's everywhere.
It really is.
And
it even has something to do with inflammation and wound healing.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, it's... Well, apparently following positive social interactions can improve the rate or speed with which you will heal a wound.
Right.
It's a wonder drug.
It's also it's in every species. There's some form of oxytocin in every species. It's coupled with vasopressin, it comes down from in your central nervous system down into your blood through your posterior pituitary. It's like we've always had this. It's not a very specific hormone that does one specific thing. I want to use the word ubiquitous, but I'm not sure if that's right here.
Oh, that's the word you're looking for.
Okay, it's like it's totally affecting, and sadly, what's happened is that this is the medication that they're using with one purpose in a medicalized birth. I think it's like 80 to 90% of women in birth will have some form of synthetic oxytocin during her labor. And now, actually, the recommendation in most hospitals is they give you a shot of synthetic oxytocin right after the baby is delivered, which is when O'Donnell is saying that you normally have the most natural oxytocin. So they're putting more oxytocin into you in a synthetic form. So your own body's not controlling what's happening. So, you know,
why are they doing
that? Yeah.
What's their reason for that?
Because oxytocin causes your uterus to contract.
So they're trying to force the placenta out, right? They're trying to speed it up.
Whatever. They're trying to control the birth by using this hormone, a synthetic version of this hormone, to cause the uterus to contract harder and more frequently.
And that's actually what is the name for that?
Pitocin.
And it's actually,
hasn't that actually caused contractions that were so violent? Well, then what's it doing to their cardiovascular system?
Well, hasn't it actually caused contractions that were so violent that women's actually crushes the baby's skull?
Well, I don't know that I could say, like, I haven't looked at that, but I can say that my mom has been present for a 7-minute long contraction.
Whoa.
And there's something that happens with Pitocin where the the uterus just starts like hyper contracting.
My God. That couldn't have been good for the baby or the mother.
Well, I wouldn't think. And so this is where I'm saying that I think the lack of conversation is the problem, because I don't know how many of those care providers actually want to do that. As much as they think that that's the only way. And so I wish that they would sit down and have a chat with the 60-year-old midwife who's been doing this for decades and doesn't even know what Pitocin is.
Right.
To find out what she's been doing.
Yes.
You know, like, and let's make a bigger bag of tricks. Let's, like, come up with a lot more options. And then let's educate women on all of these options. And then in the meantime, right, my work is called Embodied Birth. Let's help women claim their bodies, get into their bodies, feel their bodies, learn how to be in their bodies, and learn how to work with them so that their wisdom can come out, so that they can transform from maiden to mother and feel empowered and transformed through it, as opposed to feeling traumatized. Or, you know, my grandmother, for instance, she doesn't even remember her births. You know, and this goes back to, I'm going to take us back to a question you had asked before, which was about how did we get here? Another piece of it that people speak to a lot is that, you know, Christianity at some point took a turn, you know, said that this is, you know, in payment for Eve's sin. You know Christianity way
more
than I do.
In other words, every woman will, I can't remember the word, but anyway, yes, she will have a bad childbirth.
So what's interesting is a woman actually, a childbirth educator, Travel's the word. She said the word is actually toil, and so it's actually work.
Oh.
But it got turned into suffer. That's the word. It got turned into suffer. And A part of the movement towards more medicalized births was actually in response to that and saying, no, I do not have to suffer during birth. Eve did not sin, whatever. And so there was a whole movement to bring something over from Germany called Twilight Sleep, which was a whole cocktail of drugs that made it so women were essentially insane while they were giving birth. They had to be tied down to the bed, straitjackets, all sorts of things, because they would become very animalistic and attack people while they were in labor. And then there was also an amnesiac in the cocktail, so that afterwards they wouldn't even remember.
Oh, my God. That's terrible.
And it was the feminists that were bringing it over because they were saying, I shouldn't have to suffer during birth.
Wow.
So part of what this generation of, part of the movement that I'm a part of is to say, well, let's actually start talking about what's ecstatic about this process. Let's start talking about what's amazing and empowering about this this process. It's the focus has been way too much on the suffering and the pain and the saving us from all of that. And let's actually talk about how I become an empowered and embodied and transformed maiden into this mother that could be that dolphin that beats the crap out of their babies to get them out of the way of harm. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
That takes some fierce, you got to be fierce and clear and know that you are saving your child by doing that.
And
lots of happens in that
Nicole,
birthing room.
Nicole, we're running out of
totally
time here. So because we're running out of time, I want to bring attention to the fact that you teach classes, because you can teach women, and I presume fathers too, how to be more embodied, how to have a positive birthing experience. And I'm looking at your website right now. It's tantricbirth.com. Embodied.
Now I call it embodied. The tantric
embodied
word
birth.
Is too confusing.
So
embodiedbirth.com.
Does embodied birth go to the same website?
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
And you've got online classes. Do you want to say just a couple things about that before we sign off?
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks, Veronica. So I do Skype sessions with a lot of people, a lot of the people who want to know more about what I'm doing or how to integrate it into their lives and their births, or working through their own births, or they're getting more into their own bodies. We can do stuff over Skype and in person if they're in Seattle. And then I have some online classes, because people were asking me who weren't in Seattle how to get access to, for instance, sexuality and birth, a mini more oxytocin class. I think we have a mini clitoral revelations on there. And, I know the two segments for the ecstatic birth telesummit. And then I travel. I mean, I've taught in Reno. I'm about to go teach in Asheville, North Carolina. I teach in Hawaii sometimes. You know, I can take different classes there. And then I have a whole 108-hour program for people that really want to look at the whole thing, you know, and how to be in this way in their births, and as birth professionals want to be this way around how they're caring for others around birth.
Well, and
really
for my listener, I just tweeted this. Tweeted your link, so that'll go out to about 6,000 of my friends out there in social network land. Yeah. Nicole Shapiro's embodied birth classes, definitely something to check out. And you're very impassioned. I have so much respect and love for you, for your work. I'm just really glad that you're doing what you're doing and being the positive healing presence that you are. And we do have to sign off now. It's just flown by. I have to have you back. Love to talk more about the happy things about birth. I think tonight we really thoroughly discussed about, you know, how backward we are in our technologically and medically advanced culture.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe next time you and I get
balance
together.
Balance it out a little bit.
Yeah. Next time we get together, we'll talk about the more sacred and miraculous aspects of it. If
awesome.
Yeah. All right, love. Thank you so much for joining me in the shame-free zone. And
thank you, Veronica. I look forward to
keep putting all that oxytocin out there. The world needs it.